From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the history of perhaps the most potent racial epithet in our language. We talk with Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy about his new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. We'll hear how rap records, comedy routines, and legal decisions are affecting the use and meaning of the word. Also, composer Jerry Goldsmith. He wrote the scores for the film Star Trek, Chinatown, and Patton, and the themes for the TV shows The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Waltons. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new recording by the Bebo Valdez Trio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 3 months to the day after the United States began military operations in Afghanistan, Pentagon officials say they're meeting their war aims. But they also say Taliban and al-Qaeda forces have not yet given up the fight. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
In the Pentagon view, the United States has made significant progress toward accomplishing the objectives of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. The Taliban regime no longer runs the country, and the war has debilitated Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. But some al-Qaeda fighters who were thought to be defeated may be considering a comeback, says Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam.
Those who have dispersed, it would appear, are trying to get back together and regroup so that they can ascertain, do they have leadership, do they have mission, can they do operations.
This regrouping is seen, for example, in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan along the border with Pakistan. U.S. warplanes have struck there 3 times in the last 4 days. That's also the region where U.S. Army Sergeant Nathan Chapman was shot and killed last week in an ambush. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
President Bush called on Congress today to pass his economic stimulus plan. During his vacation in Texas, the president pledged to make the economy and education high priorities when he returned. He met today with top economic advisors, including Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. President Bush acknowledged that the federal budget is likely to end in a deficit this year, but he said that's to be expected given that the country is in the midst of a recession, a war, and a national emergency. Democrats have blamed the president's tax cuts for wiping out the federal budget surplus. In the Mideast, the captain of the seized cargo ship carrying 50 tons of weapons said today that he worked for the Palestinian Authority. In prison interviews, Omar Akawi said the weapons were destined for the Palestinian territories. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The 44-year-old Akawi told reporters that he's been a member of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement since 1976. He said the cache of rockets, mortars, and guns seized by the Israelis was for the Palestinians. Akawi says when Arafat called for an end to Palestinian attacks on December 16th, he expected his handlers to cancel the operation. He also said he expected to be apprehended, if not by the Israelis, then by American warships or by the Egyptian authorities as the ship passed through the Suez Canal. The Palestinian Authority has denied any connection to the ship and condemned the smuggling operation, but the Israelis say statements by Akawi and other Palestinian crew members prove that it was a Palestinian operation. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana called it a grave situation that needs clarification. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 62 points to close at 10,197 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 22. The S&P 500 lost 7. This is NPR News. British Prime Minister Tony Blair stopped briefly at an airport near Kabul today, saying that the war in Afghanistan will not end until Osama bin Laden and Taliban leaders have been found. Blair's been visiting India and Pakistan over the past 2 days, hoping to reduce tensions that arose after militants staged a suicide attack on the Indian parliament. After meeting with Blair, Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf said that his country rejects all forms of terrorism. It was the first statement from Musharraf that didn't appear to exclude Islamic separatists in the disputed state of Kashmir. Classmates and teachers at Eastlake High School near Tampa, Florida, defended their memories of Charles Bishop. Bishop is the teenager who flew a small plane into a Tampa skyscraper, killing himself over the weekend. Bobby O'Brien reports from member station WUSF.
The 15-year-old student pilot was described as a troubled loner by law enforcement officials investigating the crash. But that's a mischaracterization, according to honors English teacher Andrea Perinelli, who taught Charles Bishop.
Charles was a sweet boy, intelligent, friendly. He had a good sense of humor. He laughed at my jokes and gotta have one of those to get through my class.
Police say Bishop expressed sympathy for Osama bin Laden in a suicide note. However, when discussing the 9-1-1 attacks, the teen told his journalism teacher he wanted to join the Air Force to prevent such tragedies. For NPR News, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Officials say 8 people died in traffic crashes during a snowstorm in parts of Pennsylvania and upstate New York. The storm left as much as 17 inches in Albany. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Randall Kennedy, has written a new book about one of the most hateful epithets in our culture, a word that many people can't even bring themselves to say, and instead use the euphemism the N-word. But the title of Kennedy's new book doesn't give you that option. The book is called Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Kennedy is a professor at Harvard Law School. His book raises many questions. Should a person be ousted from their job for using the word? What methods are useful in depriving the word of its destructive power? And should African Americans be able to use the word in ways forbidden to others? For example, many African American comics and rappers use the word repeatedly in their performances. Here's one of many examples Kennedy cites, a track by rapper Beanie Siegel.
Hey yo, from boys to men to the end of the road, yo, we boys to the end, never bending the cold. You got me, I got you, for our souls grow old. He shot you, he shot me, how we supposed to roll? I take a shot for my nigga, give me 2 to the ribs. Run a spot for my nigga while you doing your bid. Step pop, he sees gonna know who you is. I get it through to your whiz, that is due to the kids. For my dog, I swear to God, I sit in the box. Give me 3 hots and a cop before I snitch to the cops. 6-foot ditch, pine box, covered with rocks. Tombstone ready, die for the love is block. Know what I want in my life? I want for my brother. Know what I want for my wife? I want for my mother. It ain't a question on what I would do for my squad. Ask yourself if you really true to your squad. I'ma ride with my niggas, die with my niggas, get high with my niggas, flip pies with my niggas till my body get hard. Soul touch the sky till my number get hard. And God shut my eyes, I'ma ride with my niggas. Die with my niggas, get high with my niggas, lit pies with my niggas, till my body get hard. Soul touch the sky, till my number get hard, and dawn shut my eyes. We gon' ride.
That's Beanie Siegel. I asked Randall Kennedy why he wrote his book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word.
I wanted to write the book because telling the story of nigger, talking about the history of the word, the etymology of the word, the many, many, many controversies that have been generated by the word, telling that story is a useful vehicle by which to explore some very interesting terrain regarding race relations in American life.
But paradoxically, I think the place where you hear the word used the most is in rap music, where African-American rappers are calling each other niggers. And I thought I would just read a list from CD Now of some of the song titles with the word in the title. And this is just the list of the word where it's spelled N-I-G-G-A-Z. There's a completely different list for N-I-G-G-A-S. Okay, so here's the beginning of the list. Niggers, all niggers die. To my niggers, for my niggers, all my niggers, anything niggers, background niggers, bitch niggers, broke niggers, come on all my niggers, cash money niggers, chillin' with my niggers, cold young niggers, day the niggers took over, dead end niggers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? That it has become such a widely used word in rap, and maybe you could talk about how you think that what the meaning of it is when it's used in rap.
Well, I think that the meanings vary. I mean, one of the things that attracted me to this project was nigger is a fascinating word. It can have many, many meanings depending on the context, depending on who's speaking, depending on the inflection of voice. Sometimes the rappers and others are attempting to use the word as a sort of boomerang word, a word that's being thrown in the face of racists. Sometimes rappers and others are aware that nigger, for most of its history, has been used as a racist put down. And so what they're doing is taking this word, embracing it, saying that instead of running away from the word, instead of fleeing from the word, and instead of feeling ashamed by the word, they're going to take the word, embrace it, dust it off, and make it their own. With some of them, it's ironic play on the word. They know that the word has a menacing history, but they're attempting to play with this menacing history and sort of use playfully a word that has often been used in a hateful way. So there are lots of things that are going on. Sometimes people are just using the word not with any of those ideas in mind, but they're simply using the word woodenly. They've grown up hearing nigger this and nigger that, and they're very unthinkingly just spouting off a word that they've grown used to.
Now, in your book about the history of the word nigger, you trace the word's use in pop culture, in comedy. In comedy, you trace it back to Richard Pryor as being the first comic to work it in a pretty regular basis. Let's listen to a track from his album from 73 or 74, his album That Nigger's Crazy. And this is the track Niggers Versus the Police.
Cops put a hurting on your ass, man, you know. They really degrade you. White folks don't believe that shit, don't believe cops degrade. Oh, come on, those beatings, those people are resisting arrest. I'm tired of this harassment of police officers. Because the police live in your neighborhood, see? And you be knowing them as Officer Timpson.
Hello, Officer Timpson, going bowling tonight? Yes, nice pinto you have.
Niggas don't know him like that. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over.
Hey, officer, yes, glad to be of help.
Nigger got to be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license. Because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. Police degrade, I don't know, you know, it's awful. You wonder why a nigga don't go completely mad. You know, you do. You get your shit together, you work all week, right? And then you get dressed, you make, maybe say, cat, make $125. We get $80 if he lucky. Right, and he go out, get clean, be driving with his old lady, going out to a club, and police pull over. Get out of the car, that was a robbery, a nigga looks just like you. All right, put your hands up, take your pants down, spread your cheeks. Now, what nigga feel like having fun after that?
My guest is Randall Kennedy, author of the new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Randall Kennedy, what did you think when you first heard this Richard Pryor routine? Were you surprised to hear him using the word?
I was fairly young at the time. I was not surprised. I clearly remember listening to it and just loving it. And I still do. One thing I would say is that Richard Pryor certainly used the word nigger in a way in which it had previously not been used. I mean, he used it openly. He used it before mixed audiences. He showed the wide variety of ways in which nigger could be used. Nigger as insult, nigger as window on racism, nigger as a sort of an ironic play on race relations, nigger as term of endearment.
I want to play another comedy routine that you refer to in your book, and this is by Chris Rock. This is much more recent, and it's called Niggers Versus Black People. Let's hear it.
Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. There's some shit going on with black people right now. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people and there's niggas. And niggas have got to go. Every time black people want to have a good time, ignorant-ass niggas f*** it up. Can't do shit without some ignorant-ass niggas f***ing it up. Can't do nothing. Can't keep a disco open more than 3 weeks. Grand opening, grand closing. Can't go to a movie the first week it come out. Why? Because niggas are shooting at the screen. What kind of ignorant shit is that? Hey, this is a good movie. This is so good, I got to bust a cap in here. Hey, I love black people, but I hate niggas, bro. Oh, I hate niggas. Boy, I wish they let me join the Ku Klux Klan. I'd do a drive-by from here to Brooklyn. Tired of niggas, man. You can't have when you're around niggas. You can't have no big screen TV. You can have it, but you better move it in at 3 a.m. Painted white, hope niggas think it's a bassinet. Can't have shit in your house. Why? Because niggas will break in your house. Niggas will live next door to you, break in your house, and come over the next day and go, I heard you got robbed.
My guest is Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy, author of the new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. What do you think of that Chris Rock routine, and what's he doing with the word?
I thought it was a brilliant routine, and what he's trying to do, again, like Richard Pryor, is to illuminate African-American life. One of the reasons why this routine took off is precisely because it resonated. It wasn't as if he was saying things that other people had not said. It was just that he was saying them out in public.
My guest is Randall Kennedy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Kennedy. He's a professor of law at Harvard University and author of the new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Do you remember the first time you heard the word?
I do not remember the first time I heard the word. And the reason for that is because, frankly, this word has been around me all my life. And it's a very familiar word to me.
What kind of context did you hear it in? I mean, was it used against you as a racial epithet when you were growing up?
Well, the answer to that is yes. I've been called a nigger by people who sought to hurt me. I've been called a nigger as a term of endearment. This is my nigger. This is my main nigger. I have heard the word used by people who were attempting to, in my family, who were attempting to dramatize racism and bring home to me how terrible racism is and has been. I've heard the word used by relatives who were using it in a self-hating way. Black people who were using the word nigger in such a way as to drive home how much they distrusted or disliked their fellow black Americans. So I've heard the word used across the spectrum.
What advice did your parents give you when you were young about how to handle it if someone used that epithet in describing you?
I got diametrically opposed advice. My father said that if somebody is attempting to hurt you by calling you nigger, you have my permission, he said, to go to war against the person or persons. He said, make sure you're not outnumbered, but if you're not outnumbered, or at least you're not outnumbered too badly, go to war and, you know, look around, pick up sticks if you need to, pick up rocks and hurt them. My mother, on the other hand, thought that my father's advice was wrong, and her advice was sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can never harm you. Ignore the bigots.
Which advice did you follow?
I followed both. I have fought people who called me nigger on the playground, and I have ignored people who called me nigger. So I followed both.
I want to say something about how I sometimes feel on the air when the word comes up. Like, for instance, when it came up in the O.J. case, should the word be allowed to be used in the courtroom when quoting Mark Furman? So I don't mean that I'd be using the word as a racial epithet to express my feelings, but rather in quoting, say, a court case or in quoting a lyric, because I have sometimes gone with N-word on the air. But the truth is, I've heard the word used so much in comedy routines and in rap music that it doesn't have either the meaning or the power that it used to, because the meaning has kind of been changed as it's been appropriated by African Americans in pop culture. And so I almost feel hypocritical or dishonest when I use the N-word version of it, because the whole sound of the word has been changed for me because African Americans have taken the word and changed it.
I think many people feel that way, and to a large degree, I think that's a very good development. I think that the appropriation of the word by African Americans has defanged the word, has taken away some of the punch. This is an idea, by the way, that was championed by Lenny Bruce, the great comedian. He, in the 1960s, one of his comedy routines, he explicitly said, listen, let's use the word nigger a lot and thereby get rid of the power that comes with any taboo. And there have been some other people that
I'm actually going to stop you here because we have that Lenny Bruce routine standing by. So why don't we hear an excerpt of this? This is Lenny Bruce recorded, I believe, in around 62 or 63.
Are there any niggers here tonight? What did he say? Are there any niggers here tonight? Jesus Christ, he had to get that low for laughs. Have I ever talked about the Schwarzes when the Schwarzes have gone? Or spoke about the Moulin Johns? Or placated some southerner by absence of voice and he ranted and raved about nigger, nigger, nigger? Are there any niggers? I know the one nigger that works here. I see him back there. Oh, there's two niggers, customers, and... but between those three niggers sits one kike. Thank God for the kike. But two kikes. That's two kikes and three niggers and one spick. One spick. Three spicks. One mick. One mick. One spick. One hick, fick, funky, spunky, boogie. And there's another kike. Three kikes, one guinea, one grease ball. Three grease balls, two guineas, one hunky funky lace curtain Irish mick. That mick spick funky hunky boogie. Five more niggers. I pass with six niggers and eight micks and four spicks.
That's Lenny Bruce. Randall Kennedy, what do you think he accomplishes in that?
Well, he's accomplishing a variety of things. One thing is he's showing that the American language is filled with slurs, with various ethnic racial slurs. And, of course, those racial ethnic slurs are monuments to a very ugly aspect of American culture, namely various sorts of bigotries. And so in his comedy routine, what he was doing was getting people to think about bigotry in American life, and that was a good thing. He was revealing something about American life, which Americans all too often try to forget about. He also had a theory of that these slurs could be made less harmful if people stated them, and if they were heard, And there have been other people who have embraced this theory as well. There was a gentleman in California who tried to change his name to Mr. Nigger so that when he was describing himself or introducing himself or filling out various forms, he would have to use the word nigger, 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 nigger over and over again to describe himself. And he actually took this to court because the California courts were not willing to officially change his name. They said that he could do it himself, but that the power of the state would not be used to effectuate his purpose. And when he described what he was attempting to do, he was attempting to defang the word, to get people used to hearing the word and thereby making the word less powerful.
And he was African-American?
And he was African-American, yes.
Let me tell you the next dilemma I think I'm going to face. I hope sometime in the next few weeks to interview Ice Cube, the rapper and actor. And he used to be in the group Niggers with Attitude, and he uses that word a lot, and he has used that word a lot in his music. If I want to quote a lyric of his, if I want to quote one of his own raps, I'll have to decide, well, do I use the word N-word, or do I use the word that he used, nigger? And I think it's such a complicated dilemma, because on the one hand, I'll feel like I could be misinterpreted, even though I'm quoting his lyric, if I actually use the word. On the other hand, if I use the word N-word, it seems so disingenuous to have to tone down his own language when talking to him directly about it. I mean, he's the one who used it.
Are you asking for my advice?
Yeah.
My advice would be to go on and use the word in the way in which he uses it.
Mm-hmm.
As for misunderstanding, yes, there will be misunderstanding. And what I would say to that is, anybody who ventures onto the sort of topic that we're talking about has to recognize that there's going to be misunderstanding, that there are going to be some people who are going to be angry at you. If you don't want people, if you want to avoid misunderstandings totally, if you want to avoid people being angry with you totally, then you should stay clear of any discussion of nigger or any other provocative subject.
Randall Kennedy is the author of Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. He's a professor at Harvard Law School. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at AudiUSA.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life by Philip Simmons. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by Cuban pianist Bebo Valdez. We meet film composer Jerry Goldsmith, who wrote the scores for Star Trek, Patton, and Chinatown. And we continue our conversation with Randall Kennedy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy, author of the new book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. It traces the etymology of the word, analyzes its destructive power, and considers how African-American rappers and comics have been using the word in their performances. Now, you're a law professor. You raise several legal questions in the book, including, should the law view the word as a provocation that reduces the culpability of a person who responds violently to it? And under what circumstances, if any, should a person be ousted from his or her job for saying the word nigger? Would you describe one of the more perplexing legal cases involving the word that you came in touch with?
Sure. Let me back a moment and say that I think that the moment that this project really caught fire was when I put the word nigger into the LexisNexis database and asked for LexisNexis to give me a citation to every federal and state court case where this word appeared in a reported decision. And LexisNexis indicated that there were in excess of 4,000 cases where nigger appeared. And I started reading through those cases, and that's when it really became clear to me that I was on to something by trying to write a series of pieces that would explore controversies generated by this word. Now, to answer your question directly, one set of cases that I found particularly interesting had to do with the following. How should the law respond if a defendant claimed that his culpability should be reduced because he responded violently to the word a nigger? This arose, for instance, in a case in Washington, D.C., where a janitor at the National Cathedral was apparently called nigger by a secretary. He slapped the secretary in response. She screamed to stop her from screaming. He choked her, ultimately killed her. He was tried for first-degree murder. His lawyer, a very great attorney, Charles Hamilton Houston, the man who was the great teacher of Thurgood Marshall, Charles Hamilton Houston argued that the man should not be sentenced to death for first-degree murder, but rather the charge should be reduced to second-degree murder because he lost his head, that when this woman called him nigger, it, in a way, it drove him almost temporarily insane. That was the nature of the argument that was made. This case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. A number of justices thought that Charles Hamilton Houston's argument for the defendant should have been presented to the jury, that the jury should have been able to reduce the culpability of the defendant. Ultimately, the defendant lost, and he was, in fact, executed. But this whole idea of should the law, to some extent, excuse a person who responds violently to this epithet, that's an interesting issue. And it still pops up, by the way. A couple of years ago in Washington, D.C., two black men got in an argument. One of the black men called the other a nigger. The one who was the target of the slur assaulted the other one. And the defendant, again, tried to say, listen, my culpability should be reduced. The Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia said no. That in the District of Columbia, as in many jurisdictions in the United States, mere words, no matter how insulting, do not excuse violence. So this is an ongoing issue.
Now, some college campuses have speech codes now which regulate hate speech, and there's a punishment for using words like nigger. Is there such a code on the Harvard campus where you teach?
The code at Harvard, as I understand it, essentially says that speech at Harvard University shall be governed according to First Amendment standards. And so to the extent that the First Amendment provides protection for speech, to that extent, Harvard University will provide protection for speech. Let me go back to your earlier question about interesting cases and note one of the, I think, one of the more interesting cases that I discuss in the book. It has a legal dimension, but actually I'm not so much interested in the legal dimension as the political dimension. That's a case that arose at Central Michigan University, the Dambrot case. This is a case in which there was a white coach of a predominantly black basketball team, and the team was losing at halftime. And during halftime in the locker room, this white coach says to the players, "Can I use the N-word with you all?" And the players nod, saying, "Yes, you can use the N-word with us." And the coach says, "Well, I've heard you say during your amongst yourselves, you say that to be a nigger on the basketball court is to play with heart, is to play with intensity, is to play with verve. Now, you're losing this game, and one of the reasons why you're losing the game is because you're not playing like niggers." And then this coach went around and said, pointed to a couple of the players. In fact, he pointed to one of the white players and said, "Now, so-and-so here is playing like a nigger." And then he pointed to one of the black players and said, "Now, so-and-so here is playing like a nigger. But the rest of you all are not. The rest of you all are not playing tough. You're not playing with intensity." Well, first of all, it should be noted that the team ultimately lost the game. But worse for Coach Dambrot is that a student who had actually been cut from the team earlier, a black student, wrote a letter to school authorities telling them about Coach Dambrot's statement to the team at halftime in the locker room. School authorities alert the athletic director. The athletic director tells Dambrot to never use that term again. Dambrot says, "Okay, I won't." But the story doesn't end there. The story gets out. There's some publicity. There are demonstrations. And Dambrot is suspended for a while. And the team is told to undergo sort of a sensitivity session. The story doesn't end there. Ultimately, Dambrot is fired from his job because of this halftime talk that he gave. At that point, Dambrot sues to get his job back, and the team sues to strike down that institution's hate speech regulations, because one of the reasons why Dambrot was fired from his job was because his use of the word nigger in that context was said to have violated the hate speech regulations. Ironically, the team prevailed. The hate speech regulations were struck down by a United States district judge. Dambrot, however, did not prevail. For various legal matters that we needn't get into here, the judge ruled that the school authorities were within their rights in firing Dambrot. My take on this was that Dambrot was certainly imprudent in his use of nigger in that context. It was simply too great a risk of misunderstanding. I thought that he was imprudent. But I also thought that the school authorities went way overboard in firing this man from his job, since it was quite clear that he was not intending to insult anyone. But that, too, was an interesting case, along with many, many other interesting cases that I came across in exploring nigger in court.
Brenda Kennedy, one more question before we have to wrap up, and that is, you've put your readers in the position of going to bookstores and saying, "Excuse me, but do you have that new book, Nigger, in stock?" And that's going to make a lot of people really uncomfortable, the people asking the questions and the people being asked the questions. Have you witnessed any of that yet?
Yes, I definitely have, in a variety of ways. Reporters who have interviewed me about the book have come to my office, taken the book out of their briefcase, and I've noticed that a cover from another book was over the cover for this book. They felt, and I've asked them about it, and they said, geez, you know, I felt, frankly, uncomfortable being on a subway or being on a bus reading this book with nigger in big letters on the cover. This has come up in other ways as well, with people making reference to the book, but in all sorts of ways that enable them to evade having to mention the title for the book. So I'm sure that there is going to be a certain amount of awkwardness that arises in bookstores and other places where this book is at issue.
Well, Randall Kennedy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Randall Kennedy is the author of Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. He's a professor at Harvard Law School. Coming up, composer Jerry Goldsmith. He wrote the scores for the films Chinatown, Patton, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. This is Fresh Air. My guest, composer Jerry Goldsmith, has written many great movie scores, including Chinatown, Star Trek The Motion Picture, Patton, A Patch of Blue, the original Planet of the Apes, and L.A. Confidential. He also wrote the TV themes for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Dr. Kildare, The Waltons, and Barnaby Jones. He's received one Academy Award, 17 additional nominations, and 5 Emmy Awards. A new CD called The Film Music of Jerry Goldsmith features him conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in performances of many of his movie and TV themes. Let's start with his score from Patton, the World War II movie starring George C. Scott as General George Patton. This version is from the soundtrack of the film.
People talk about Patton as a war film. I never viewed it as a war film. I viewed it as a personal documentary or biography of a man who was a warrior, yes, but there were two other aspects of him, which I did capture in the music. He was a very religious man, in spite of his profane personality, and he was also a total intellectual and a deep believer in reincarnation and history, and he spoke fluent French. He was cultured in musically. I mean, the dichotomy of the man, and you know how profane he was, but yet there was this depth of. So he was a complex personality, and I tried capturing these three levels of his personality in music by the fanfare, which has become sort of well known, is meant to represent the archaic part of him, the historical, the intellectual part of him. The chorale was to represent the religious aspect of him, and of course the military aspect, and it was designed contrapuntally so that all three could be played simultaneously or individually or two at a time, whatever.
Now I want to talk about another theme that you wrote, and that's the theme for Chinatown, which I think is really just one of the great scores. Let's talk about the opening theme.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific part of the movie or a specific emotion within the movie that you wanted that opening theme to evoke or address?
The story was that the picture had been recorded before scored by someone else before, and then they previewed it. And actually, the previews in the picture were evidently, from what I was told, were not very successful. And the music was not very good either. I must say that when I did see the picture, I had heard a little of the music, and it was Chinese, so it seemed rather inappropriate for the film. So anyway, so I was called in to do it, and I had to do the score in 10 days, which was a very short period of time to do it. And the producer, Robert Evans, had said to me, we should have a period feel in the music, period feel being a style of the 30s. And I said, well, you've got that in this Bunny Berrigan recording you're using. Is, you know, it's coming off the radio and all that. And you see that in the cinematography and the costumes, the wardrobe, and the whole feel, the look of the picture was 30s Los Angeles. And I grew up, I was here as a young kid in the 30s. I know what it looked like and felt like. And that was the amazing thing about this picture. It was that feel was so true. I said, so musically, I want to try and go for the tragedy of the story. I finished recording it, and the movie came out like 3 days later, so we were really right down to the wire on it. So I didn't have a lot of time to think. I just had to sit down and write a theme for this movie and get on with it.
Well, why don't we hear your opening theme from Chinatown? That's Jerry Goldsmith's theme from the movie Chinatown. Now, you've written the themes for several TV shows. Dr. Kildare, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., both of those are on your new CD.
The Waltons.
Why don't we hear the theme that you wrote for The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Okay.
Anything you want to say about it?
I guess during the 60s, late 50s and 60s, we all had to be versatile, so we had to have jazz influence on our music, and so that was what I sort of tried to do, but to make it more interesting, I originally wrote it in 5/4, which, except for Dave Brubeck, was not really a meter that was particularly common in jazz. And an interesting side note of this whole thing is after the first season, they wanted to save money, and I had written it for a larger group, like it was 20 players, and they wanted to cut it down to a little like 4 or 5 piece, because you had to pay each year to re-record the theme. So I wanted to save money, so I was unavailable, so they hired Lalo Schifrin. And Lalo did a very hip arrangement of it for a small group, and that's really what they used for the years of however long the show was on the air. It was Lalo's arrangement of the theme.
Jerry Goldsmith, thank you so much for talking with us.
And Terry, it was great. A great honor to be here.
the theme from The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Jerry Goldsmith conducts the London Symphony Orchestra performing his movie and TV themes on the new CD, The Film Music of Jerry Goldsmith. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by Cuban pianist Bebo Valdez. This is Fresh Air. In Havana in the 1940s and 50s, pianist Bebo Valdez was one of the pioneers of mixing Cuban popular music with jazz. After the Cuban Revolution, he settled in Sweden and worked a lot of hotel gigs. Meanwhile, back home, his son Chucho Valdez went on to become one of Cuba's best-known jazz musicians. Then came 1999's Buena Vista Social Club. Suddenly, older Cubans who could play in pre-revolutionary styles were a hot ticket, allowing Bebo to make a comeback. In 2000, Bebo Valdez came to New York to appear in the documentary Calle 54 and record a trio CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's low-key, but as likable as a suave grandfather.
Of Latin jazz, and you probably picture a big band with lots of screaming trumpets and crisscrossing percussion. Bebo Valdez music seems to come from an earlier time, when the Havana vanguard was just loosening up their parents' stately ballroom steps. Because a small band is easier to maneuver than a big one, this parlor trio can sound like a folklore group one minute and a jazz combo the next. This is not a bad combination. Valdez Compadres, on his new CD for Blue Note, are two mainstays of New York's Latin scene. The congas of Carlos Petato Valdez, no relation, have graced a zillion Latin and jazz records since the 50s. On bass is Mambo King Israel Lopez, a.k.a. Cachao. He always favors a dignified dance beat and keeps his bow in hand even while plucking the strings, just in case. Cuban music has closer ties to West African polyrhythms than most North American music. But where Latin big bands stack different rhythms on top of each other, in his solos, Bebo Valdez will string out various rhythmic figures one after another. He'll also toss in quotes from the light classics and twinkling octave runs that recall flashy pianists of yore like Carmen Cavallero or Liberace. But the rhythm section and his own good taste keep him from going too far. Thank you. Most of the tunes on Bebo Valdez's El Arte del Sabor, The Art of Flavor, are older Cuban songs. The one item from the American repertoire is Bobby Troup's classic, Route 66. Valdez takes his little rhythmic side trips and nods toward a few well-known jazz tunes, and I like how Potato Valdez implies a swinging cymbal beat on congas. His dry sound gives the trio its own rugged profile. This music was recorded. Bebo Valdez and Cachao were both well into their 80s, and once in a while the pianist sounds like he's back in the hotel lounge. But this date has enough charm to make up for any lapses, and Paquito de Rivera adds saxophone or clarinet to three pieces for variety and a little extra snap. The core trio don't sound like kids, but that's the hook. They breathe life into the old music, playing it the way it should be played, modernizing just enough to keep it from sounding archaic. Works for me.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed El Arte del Sabor, the new recording by the Bebo Valdez Trio on Blue Note. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ingrid Betancourt. After serving in the Colombian Congress and Senate, she's now running for president on an anti-drug, anti-corruption platform. Many death threats have been directed against her and her family. Rather than back down, she sent her children to live with their grandparents in New Zealand. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.